idea would invalidate the actions and goals of the Western individual, would destroy the Western dominance hierarchy, the social context for individual action. In the absence of this central assumption, the body of Western law, formalized myth, codified morality, erodes and falls. There are no individual rights, no individual value, and the foundation of the Western social and psychological structure dissolves. The Second World War and Cold War were fought largely to eliminate such a challenge. For the man whose beliefs have become abstracted, and therefore more doubtful, more debatable, the mere strange idea of the stranger is sufficient to disrupt the stability of everyday presumption. Tolstoy, in his Confessions, recalls the impact of modern Western European ideas on the too-long static medieval culture of Russia. I remember that when I was 11 years old, a high school boy named Volodinka M., now long since dead, visited us one Sunday with an announcement of the latest discovery made at school. The discovery was that there is no God, and that the things they were teaching us were nothing but fairy tales. This was in 1838. I remember how this news captured the interest of my older brothers. They even let me in on their discussions. I remember that we were all very excited, and that we took this news to be both engaging and entirely possible. This discovery, which was in fact the cumulative result of a very lengthy and traumatic Western European cognitive process, had the capacity to undermine the most fundamental presuppositions of Russian culture, as it had undermined those of the West. Tolstoy continues, "Since ancient times, when the life of which I do know something began, people who knew the arguments concerning the vanity of life, the arguments that revealed to me its meaninglessness, lived nonetheless, bringing to life a meaning of their own. Since the time when people somehow began to live, this meaning of life has been with them, and they have led this life up to my own time. Everything that is in me and around me is the fruit of their knowledge of life. The very tools of thought by which I judge life and condemn it were created not by me, but by them. I myself was born, educated, and have grown up, thanks to them. They dug out the iron, taught us how to cut the timber, tamed the cattle and the horses, showed us how to sow crops and live together. They brought order to our lives. They taught me how to think and to speak. I am their offspring, nursed by them, reared by them, taught by them. I think according to their thoughts, their words. And now I have proved to them that it is all meaningless." This rational undermining eventually, inevitably, produced the following effects, as Tolstoy relates. "It happened with me, as it happens with everyone who contracts a fatal internal disease. At first, there were the insignificant symptoms of an ailment, which the patient ignores. Then these symptoms recur more and more frequently until they merge into one continuous duration of suffering. The suffering increases, and before he can turn around, the patient discovers what he already knew. The thing he had taken for a mere indisposition is in fact the most important thing on earth to him, is in fact death. This is exactly what happened to me. I realized that this was not an incidental ailment, but something very serious, and that if the same questions should continue to recur, I would have to answer them. And I tried to answer them. The questions seemed to be such foolish, simple, childish questions. But as soon as I laid my hands on them and tried to resolve them, I was immediately convinced, first of all, that they were not childish and foolish questions, but the most vital and profound questions in life, and secondly, that no matter how much I pondered them, there was no way I could resolve them. Before I could be occupied with my samsara estate, with the education of my son, or with the writing of books, I had to know why I was doing these things. As long as I do not know the reason why, I cannot do anything. In the middle of my concern with the household, which at the time kept me quite busy, a question would suddenly come into my head. Very well. You will have 6,000 desyatins in the Samara province, as well as 300 horses. What then? And I was completely taken aback and did not know what else to think. As soon as I started to think about the education of my children, I would ask myself, why? Or I would reflect on how the people might attain prosperity, and I would suddenly ask myself, what concern is it of mine? Or in the middle of thinking about the fame that my works were bringing me, I would say to myself, very well, you will be more famous than Gogol, Pushkin, Shakespeare, Molière, more famous than all the writers in the world. So what? And I could find absolutely no reply. My life came to a stop. I could breathe, eat, drink, and sleep. Indeed, I could not help but breathe, eat, drink, and sleep, but there was no life in me, because I had no desires whose satisfaction I would have found reasonable. If I wanted something, I knew beforehand that it did not matter whether or not I got it. If a fairy had come and offered to fulfill my every wish, I would not have known what to wish for. If, in moments of intoxication, I should have not desires but the habits of old desires, in moments of sobriety I knew that it was all a delusion, that I really desired nothing. I did not even want to discover truth anymore, because I had guessed what it was. The truth was that life is meaningless. And it was as though I had lived a little, wandered a little, until I came to the precipice, and I clearly saw that there was nothing ahead except ruin. And there was no stopping, no turning back, no closing my eyes, so I would not see that there was nothing ahead except the deception of life and of happiness and the reality of suffering and death, of complete annihilation. I grew sick of life. Some irresistible force was leading me to somehow get rid of it. It was not that I wanted to kill myself. The force that was leading me away from life was more powerful, more absolute, more all-encompassing than any desire. With all my strength, I struggled to get away from life. The thought of suicide came to me as naturally then as did the thought of improving life had come to me before. This thought was such a temptation that I had to use cunning against myself in order not to go through with it too hastily. I did not want to be in a hurry only because I wanted to use all my strength to untangle my thoughts. If I could not get them untangled, I told myself, I could always go ahead with it. And there I was, a fortunate man, carrying a rope from my room where I was alone every night as I undressed, so that I would not hang myself from the beam between the closets. And I quit going hunting with a gun, so that I would not be too easily tempted to rid myself of life. I myself did not know what I wanted. I was afraid of life. I struggled to get rid of it, and yet I hoped for something from it. And this was happening to me at a time when, from all indications, I should have been considered a completely happy man. This was when I was not yet 50 years old. I had a good, loving, and beloved wife, fine children, and a large estate that was growing and expanding without any effort on my part. More than ever before, I was respected by friends and acquaintances, praised by strangers, and I could claim a certain renown without really deluding myself. Moreover, I was not physically and mentally unhealthy. On the contrary, I enjoyed a physical and mental vigor such as I had rarely encountered among others my age. Physically, I could keep up with the peasants working in the fields. Mentally, I could work 8 and 10 hours at a stretch without suffering any after effects from the strain. And in such a state of affairs, I came to a point where I could not live, and even though I feared death, I had to employ ruses against myself to keep from committing suicide. I described my spiritual condition to myself in this way. My life is some kind of stupid and evil practical joke that someone is playing on me. In spite of the fact that I did not acknowledge the existence of any someone who might have created me, the notion that someone brought me into the world as a stupid and evil joke seemed to be the most natural way to describe my condition. Group identity, inculcated morality, and accepted interpretation serves to constrain the motivational significance of experiential phenomena. When that identity, which is predicated upon implicit or explicitly held faith in a particular conceptualization of the way, is challenged, such constraints vanish. This deconstruction of symbolically patriarchal custom and belief subjects the individual to intrapsychic war of conflicting affect, the clash of opposites in Jungian terms. It subjugates him or her to unbearable cognitive, emotional, and moral conflict. Nietzsche's comments on Hamlet, sicklied o'er by the pale cast of thought, are relevant in this context. Knowledge kills action. Action requires the veils of illusion. That is the doctrine of Hamlet. Now, no comfort avails anymore. Longing transcends a world after death, even the gods. Existence is negated, along with its glittering reflection in the gods or in an immortal beyond. Conscious of the truth he has once seen, man now sees everywhere only the horror or absurdity of existence. Now he understands what is symbolic in Ophelia's fate. Now he understands the wisdom of the sylvan god Silenus. He is nauseated. Fyodor Dostoevsky's tragically comic, bureaucratic, personality-disordered protagonist, the metaphoric mouse, in Notes from Underground, reacts similarly, comparing his own sophisticated inability to respond courageously to an insult to that of l'homme de la nature et de la vérité, the natural and therefore truthful yet comparatively unconscious procedural man. Dostoevsky writes, "Let us now look at the mouse in action. Suppose, for example, that it too has been insulted, and it will almost always be subjected to slights, and desires revenge. Perhaps even more fury will accumulate inside it than inside l'homme de la nature de la vérité, because l'homme de la nature de la vérité, with his innate stupidity, considers his revenge to be no more than justice, while the mouse, with its heightened consciousness, denies that there is any justice about it. At last comes the act itself, the revenge. The wretched mouse has by this time accumulated, in addition to the original nastiness, so many other nastinesses in the shape of questions and doubts and so many other unresolved problems in addition to the original problem that it has involuntarily collected round itself a fatal morass, a stinking bog, consisting of its own doubts and agitations, and finally of the spittle rained on it by all the spontaneous men of action standing portentously round as judges and referees and howling with laughter. Of course, nothing remains for it to do but shrug the whole thing off and creep shamefacedly into its hole with a smile of pretended contempt in which it doesn't even believe itself." The fictional characters of Shakespeare and Dostoevsky respond like the flesh-and-blood Tolstoy to the same historically determined set of circumstances, to the death of God in Nietzsche's terminology, brought about inexorably by continued development of abstract consciousness. The first modern man, Hamlet, and those who follow him in art and in life, characteristically respond like Nietzsche's pale criminal. Like Crime and Punishment's Raskolnikov, they remain unable to bear the terrible beauty of their deeds. Nietzsche states, "Of what is great, one must either be silent or speak with greatness." With greatness, that means cynically and with innocence. What I relate is the history of the next two centuries. I describe what is coming, what can no longer come differently. the advent of nihilism. Our whole European culture is moving for some time now with a tortured tension that is growing from decade to decade as toward a catastrophe. Restlessly, violently, headlong, like a river that wants to reach the end, that no longer reflects, that is afraid to reflect. He that speaks here has, conversely, done nothing so far but to reflect. As a philosopher and solitary by instinct, who has found his advantage in standing aside, outside. Why has the advent of nihilism become necessary? Because the values we have had hitherto thus draw their final consequence. Because nihilism represents the ultimate logical conclusion of our great values and ideals. Because we must experience nihilism before we can find out what value these values really had. We require at some time new values. Nihilism stands at the door. Whence comes this uncanniest of all guests? Point of departure. It is an error to consider social distress or physiological degeneration or corruption of all things as the cause of nihilism. Ours is the most honest and compassionate age. Distress, whether psychic, physical, or intellectual, need not at all produce nihilism. That is the radical rejection of value, meaning, and desirability. Such distress always permits a variety of interpretations. Rather, it is in one particular interpretation, the Christian moral one, that nihilism is rooted. The end of Christianity, at the hands of its own morality, which cannot be replaced, which turns against the Christian God, the sense of truthfulness highly developed by Christianity is nauseated by the falseness and mendaciousness of all Christian interpretations of the world and of history. Rebound from God is the truth to the fanatical faith, all is false, an act of Buddhism. Skepticism regarding morality is what is decisive. The end of the moral interpretation of the world, which no longer has any sanction after it has tried to escape into some beyond, leads to nihilism. All lacks meaning. The untenability of one interpretation of the world, upon which a tremendous amount of energy has been lavished, awakens the suspicion that all interpretations of the world are false. That, in a nutshell, is cascade. Nihilism, alter ego of totalitarianism, is response to experience of the world, self and other, rendered devoid of certain meaning, and therefore allowed no meaning. Is reaction to the world freed from the unconscious constraints of habit, custom, and belief. Is response to the re-emergence of the terrible unknown. Is reaction of a spirit no longer able, as a consequence of abstract critical ability, to manifest unconscious or procedural identity with the hero, no longer able to muster belief in human possibility in the face of exposure to the most dreadful imaginable. Phenomena remain constrained in their affective significance, at least partially, because the group, the dominance hierarchy, has reached agreement as to their meaning, their implications for situation-specific action. When that hierarchy falls, perhaps as a consequence of emergent disbelief in central presumption, nothing remains sacred. This process becomes evidently manifest from the empirical viewpoint during a riot. When law and order are held temporarily in abeyance, when the inhibitory force of imposed threat is relieved, when the dominance hierarchy momentarily collapses, those whose moral behavior remains predicated upon resentful obedience fall prey to their own disordered affect and explode in aggression, greed, hatred, and vengeful destructiveness. This explosion, or implosion, is reduction to the pre-cosmogonic continuum from the pre-experimental or mythic viewpoint, regression to the time and place prior to the division of things into known and unknown, This can be viewed either as alteration in affect or transformation of the motivational significance of the phenomena whose apprehension motivates behavior. The objective mind would postulate the former, the mythic mind concerned with subjective reality, the latter. This form of regression exists as precondition to creative restructuring. Semi-conscious, semi-declarative apprehension of this affect-laden state, manifest as paralyzing fear, exists, fortunately and catastrophically, as the greatest impediment to change. The dominance hierarchy of value, extant socially and intrapsychically, employs fear and promise to regulate access to desired commodities, to determine the net motivational significance of particular events and processes. Any given phenomenon is capable of inducing a variety of affective or motivational states. It is the socially and individually determined outcome of competition between these intrapsychic states that determines behavioral output. The internalized consequence of the external dominance hierarchy, which is the intrapsychic patriarchy, Freud's superego, is knowledge of the net motivational relevance of phenomena within a particular society. This implies, as stated previously, that the historically determined power structure of a given society could be inferred through analysis of the significance granted technological and cognitive artifacts by the individuals within that society. What is desired depends upon the goal toward which a given society moves. The goal is posited as valuable initially, as a consequence of the operation of unconscious presumptions hypothetically preceding action. The value presupposed by the action is then coded episodically, then perhaps formalized semantically. Someone from a different culture values things differently. This difference is predicated upon acceptance of an alternate goal-directed schema. The nature and presence of this difference may be inferred, will, in fact, necessarily be inferred from observation of foreign behavior, imagination, and discussion, even inferred, perhaps, from exposure to cultural artifacts, which are generally granted the status of mere tools, which is to say, implements of the way, or from cues as subtle as voice or procedural melody. Movement from one schema to another, or from both to a hypothetical third, which unites both, which might constitute the consequence of revolutionary heroic effort, presupposes dissolution, mutual or singular, not mere addition, a qualitative shift, not a quantitative shift. Mythically, as we have seen, this movement might be represented as descent from the precipice into the abyss, as the collapse of the idol with feet of clay, as dissolution to constituent bodily or material elements, as journey to the underworld or sea bottom, as sojourn through the valley of the shadow of death, as 40 years or 40 days in the desert, as encounter with the hydra, as incest with the mother. When such a journey is undertaken voluntarily, resources prepared adequately beforehand, faith in place, chance of success, return, reconstitution, resurrection, ascent is substantially enhanced. When dissolution occurs accidentally, when encounter with the unknown is unintentional or avoided beyond its time of inevitable occurrence, intrapsychic or social catastrophe, suicide or war becomes certain. The goal toward which behavior is devoted serves as one pole of the cognitive schema that determines the motivational significance of events. Members of the same culture share the same goal. This goal consists of a hypothetical desired state that exists in contrast to some conceptualization of the present and that can be attained through participation in a particular consensually accepted and traditionally determined process. This schema is analogous in structure to the normal mythological conception of the way, which includes a representation of the troubled present, a conception of the desired future, and a description of methods, moral prescriptions, and injunctions for transforming the former into the latter. Moral knowledge serves to further the way by reducing the infinite potential motivational significance of particular events to the particular and determinant. This process of reduction is social in nature. Events take on established meaning that is socially determined, shared. The affective relevance of a given phenomenon, which, most fundamentally, is its significance for goal-directed behavior, is a consequence of the operation of the goal-oriented schema, which finds partial expression in establishment of a dominance hierarchy. A dominance hierarchy is a social arrangement which determines access to desired commodities. In most cases, these commodities are cues for consummatory reward, experiences that signify movement toward or increased likelihood of attaining the desired goal. Relative position in the dominance hierarchy, at least in the perfectly functioning society, is in itself determined through social judgment. That judgment reflects appreciation of the value of a particular individual. That value reflects how society views the ability of that individual to contribute to attainment of the goal. This interpretation, of course, implies that the postulation of a given way necessarily, inevitably, produces a hierarchy of value, since people and things will inevitably differ in their utility as means to the desired end. Every phenomenon experienced within the confines of a particular society is laden with dominance hierarchy and goal schema relevant information. The value of any particular item or experience is determined by the mythic foundation upon which the entire society consciously and unconsciously rests. This value is the magic of the object. Schismatic activity, semantic, episodic, or procedural, might be considered the within-group equivalent to arrival of an abstracted or concrete stranger. Cultural schisms emerge when once predictable and familiar individuals become possessed by novel behavioral notions, images, or semantic formulations, which present a challenge to presumptions deemed necessarily inviolable, such as the most dangerous authoritarian presumption that all currently accepted presumptions are true. Medieval horror of heresy and the drastic responses to such ideation defined as necessary by the Catholic guardians of proper thought is rendered comprehensible as a consequence of consideration, one, of the protective function of intact dogma, and two, of the methodological impossibility of disproving, so to speak, alternative mythically founded narrative ideas. The Christian Church fragmented chaotically, and perhaps creatively, and continues to do so with horrendous consequences, even under conditions where such fragmentation was severely punished. This is not stated to provide justification for repression of creativity, but to make the motivation for such repression understandable. Degeneration into chaos, decadence, might be considered the constant threat of innovation undertaken in the absence of comprehension and respect for tradition. Such decadence is precisely as dangerous to the stability and adaptability of the community and the individual, and as purely motivated by underground wishes and desires, as is totalitarianism or desire for absolute order. The continuing absence of a generally accepted methodology for peaceably sorting out the relative value or validity of evident mythologically predicated differences helps ensure that savage repression will remain the frequently utilized alternative. Rapid development of semantic skill and its second-order elaboration into empirical methodology constitutes the third major threat to the continued stability of socio-historically determined adaptive cultural systems, as well as the major factor in the complex elaboration of such systems. The first two, just a reminder, were rapid natural environmental shift independent of human activity and contact with a heretofore isolated foreign culture. Literate individuals, members of cultures contained in expressed theologies or rational philosophies, can more easily incarnate and or abstractly adopt or provisionally formulate different positions with regard to the value of initial assumptions, can also verbalize the beliefs of other people, absorb them, and subject them to critical consideration or theoretically guileless acceptance, are fated necessarily to be able to become many other people in imitation, imagination, and thought. Linguistically mediated criticism of the predicates of behavior undermines faith in the validity of historically established hierarchical patterns of adaptation. The final emergent process of the developmental chain of abstraction can be applied to undermine the stability of its foundation. The modern and verbally sophisticated individual is therefore always in danger of sawing off the branch on which he or she sits. Language turned drama into mythic narrative, narrative into formal religion, and religion into critical philosophy, providing exponential expansion of adaptive ability, while simultaneously undermining assumption and expectation and dividing knowledge from action. Civilized Homo sapiens can use words to destroy what words did not create. This ability has left modern individuals increasingly subject to their worst fears. Nietzsche states, "Our Europe of today, being the arena of an absurdly sudden attempt at a radical mixture of classes and hence races, is therefore skeptical in all its heights and depths. Sometimes with that mobile skepticism which leaps impatiently and lasciviously from branch to branch, sometimes dismal like a cloud overcharged with question marks, and often mortally sick of its will. Paralysis of the will. Where today does one not find this cripple sitting? And often in such finery. How seductive the finery looks. This disease enjoys the most beautiful pomp and lie costumes, and most of what today displays itself in the showcases, for example, as objectivity, being scientific, art for the sake of art, pure knowledge free of will, is merely dressed up skepticism and paralysis of the will. For this diagnosis of the European sickness, I vouch." The intellectual developments which led to the establishment of modern scientific methodology have heightened the danger of this partially pathological tendency. The construction of a powerful and accurate representation of the objective or shared world, a logical conclusion of the interpersonal exchange of sensory information made possible by linguistic communication, challenged belief in the reality of the mythic world, which was in fact never objective. The mythic world was always affective, although it was shared socially and contained procedural information and abstracted representation thereof, arranged hierarchically in terms of value, embodied in nonverbal procedural and abstracted imagistic and semantic form. Representation of mythic value in verbal format allowed for simple experimentation in ethics, in imagination, and then often tragically in action, and for generation of naive but effective criticism regarding traditional foundations for behavior. Nietzsche states, "For this is the way in which religions are wont to die out. Under the stern, intelligent eyes of an orthodox dogmatism, the mythical premises of a religion are systematized as a sum total of historical events. One begins apprehensively to defend the credibility of the myths, while at the same time one opposes any continuation of their natural vitality and growth. The feeling for myth perishes, and its place is taken by the claim of religion to historical foundations." Sigmund Freud maintained, as an ideal 19th century empiricist, that, quote, "There is no other source of knowledge of the universe but the intellectual manipulation of carefully verified observations, that is, what is called research, and that no knowledge can be obtained from revelation, intuition, or inspiration," end quote. He said, furthermore, that There is no appeal beyond reason, grounded directly in observation, one would presume. This description leaves no place for the primal role of affect, or even of sensation, for that matter, in determination of wisdom. What causes me and others pain is wrong in the most basic and naive form, and also fails to address the issue of the source of scientific hypotheses in general, the narrative process. Furthermore, pure knowledge of the sensory world, what is most fundamentally, does not include knowledge about how to adapt to or behave in that world, even though the gathering of such information has obvious implications for such adaptation. Tolstoy states, "As presented by the learned and the wise, rational knowledge denies the meaning of life, but the huge masses of people acknowledge meaning through an irrational knowledge. And this irrational knowledge is faith, the one thing that I could not accept. This involves the God who is both one and three, the creation in 6 days, devils, angels, and everything else that I could not accept without taking leave of my senses." My position was terrible. I knew that I could find nothing in the way of rational knowledge except a denial of life. And in faith, I could find nothing except a denial of reason. And this was even more impossible than a denial of life. According to rational knowledge, it followed that life is evil and people know it. They do not have to live, yet they have lived and they do live, just as I myself had lived, even though I had known for a long time that life is meaningless and evil. According to faith, it followed that in order to understand the meaning of life, I would have to turn away from reason, the very thing for which meaning was necessary. Mythic thinking, so to speak, is also based on observation, but on observation of behavior in the world of affective experience. This means cyclical observation of action predicated upon an implicit or explicitly formulated theory of what should be, and derivation of procedural, episodic, or semantic representations thereof. This is knowledge as well, and appears in the light of careful analysis no more arbitrary than empirical description of the objective world. Perhaps it was necessary for science, struggling to escape from a cognitive world dominated by religious and mythical thinking, to devalue that world in order to set up an independent existence. That existence has long been established, however, but the process of devaluation, implicit and explicit, continues, even in fields theoretically separate from the strictly empirical. Northrop Frye states, "Ever since Plato, most literary critics have connected the word thought with dialectical and conceptual idioms and ignored or denied the existence of poetic and imaginative thought." This attitude continued into the 20th century with I.A. Richards' Science and Poetry, with its suggestion that mythical thinking has been superseded by scientific thinking, and that consequently poets must confine themselves to pseudo-statements. The early criticism of T.S. Eliot, though considerably more cautious than this, also exhibited an array of confusions clustering around the word thought. Since then, there has been a slowly growing realization that mythological thinking cannot be superseded because it forms the framework and context for all thinking. But the old views still persist, if in more sophisticated forms, and there are still far too many literary critics who are both ignorant and contemptuous of the mental processes that produce literature. Nietzsche states, similarly, but with somewhat more scorn, "Every age has its own divine type of naivety, for whose invention other ages may envy it. And how much naivety, venerable, childlike, and boundlessly clumsy naivety, lies in the scholar's faith in his superiority, in the good conscience of his tolerance, in the unsuspecting, simple certainty with which his instinct treats the religious man as an inferior and lower type that he has outgrown, leaving it behind, beneath him, him, that presumptuous little dwarf and rabble man, the assiduous and speedy head and handiworker of ideas, of modern ideas. Mythological thinking is not mere arbitrary superstition. Its denigration, cascading even through literary criticism in recent years, is not only unwarranted, but perilous. This is not to say that religious institutions and dogmas are not prey to the same weaknesses as all other human creations. The ideas and patterns of action that underlay and generated those institutions remain of critical importance, however, remain important for sustaining individual emotional stability, maintaining group tolerance, cohesion, and flexibility, supporting capacity to adapt to the strange, and strengthening ability to resist domination by one-sided and murderous ideologies. The idea that we have superseded such thinking is a prime example of the capacity of the semantic system to partially represent and to thoroughly criticize. This is wrong, arrogant, and dangerous. The group promotes an integrated pattern of behavior and conception of values. This is strength, in that an integrated pattern provides one message and therefore promotes unity and direction. It is also weakness, in that integration, stable, hierarchically organized structure, is inflexible and therefore brittle. This means the group and those who identify with it cannot easily develop new modes of perception or change direction when such change or development becomes necessary. Under stable environmental and social conditions, this is an advantage, as what worked in the past will continue to work in the present. However, in times of transition, of rapid environmental transformation, of multicultural contact, of technological or ideological advance, stability is not necessarily sufficient. The Russian neuropsychologist Sokolov stated, as cited previously, "One way to improve the quality of extrapolation, judgment of match between intent and outcome, is to secure additional information. Another method is to change the principles by which such information is handled so that the process of regulation will prove more effective." This fundamental idea is embodied in mythology in the figure of the revolutionary hero. He is the fourth manner in which threat to the stability of cultural tradition may be presented and, simultaneously, is solution to the ever-recurring problem of such threat. The revolutionary hero. The revolutionary hero reorders the protective structure of society when the emergence of an anomaly makes such reordering necessary. He is, therefore, the agent of change upon whose actions all stability is predicated. This capacity, which should make him a welcome figure in every community, is exceedingly threatening to those completely encapsulated by the status quo and who are unable or unwilling to see where the present state of adaptation is incomplete and where residual danger lies. The archetypal revolutionary hero therefore faces the anger and rejection of his peers as well as the terrors of the absolutely unknown. He is, nonetheless, the best friend of the state. Analysis of the archaic ecstatic practice of shamanism, prevalent in Mircea Eliade's words, throughout the immense area comprising Central and North Asia, sheds further light on the nature of the actions and typical experiences of the revolutionary hero. Europeans who made initial contact with these tribal healers frequently deemed them insane. The reverse was in fact true. The genuine shaman was the most sane man of the tribe, that is, the man whose extent of adaptation was greatest. Furthermore, he served as primordial unified ancestor of the lately differentiated or specialized creative agent, explorer, mystic, artist, scientist, and physician. The Asian shaman was master of religious life, embodiment and keeper of the sacred doctrine, dominant authority, and creator of culture. The widespread practices and viewpoints of shamanism constitute a cohesive philosophy, so to speak, embedded unconsciously in behavior and image. This ritual philosophy comprises a set of observations about the nature of radical personality transformation and a set of practices designed to bring such alteration about. Shamanism is devoted to furtherance of the possibility of qualitative improvements in consciousness or general adaptive ability. It has captured the essence of such possibility in image to minimize the accompanying terror. Shamanism is prototypical of those religious practices designed to modify human behavior and interpretation, to induce and regulate the processes of spiritual reconfiguration. These practices are not merely cultural in nature. They originate in the observation of spontaneous psychological transmutation, a psychobiologically grounded human capacity. Shamanic rituals are therefore not merely anachronistic, without modern relevance except as curiosity dictates, but prime exemplars of a process we must come to understand. The shaman is not simply an archaic figure, an interesting anomaly from the dead past. He is the embodiment, in cultures we do not comprehend, of those people we admire most in the past. The phenomenon of the creative illness, described in detail by the existential psychotherapist Henri Ellenberger in his massive study of the history of the unconscious, is alive and well in our own culture. Ellenberger described its characteristic elements. A creative illness succeeds a period of intense preoccupation with an idea and search for a certain truth. It is a polymorphous condition that can take the shape of depression, neurosis, psychosomatic ailments, or even psychosis. Whatever the symptoms, they are felt as painful, if not agonizing, by the subject, with alternating periods of alleviation and worsening. Throughout the illness, the subject never loses the thread of his dominating preoccupation. It is often compatible with normal professional activity and family life. But even if he keeps to his social activities, he is almost entirely absorbed with himself. He suffers from feelings of utter isolation, even when he has a mentor who guides him through the ordeal, like the shaman apprentice with his master. The termination is often rapid and marked by a phase of exhilaration. The subject emerges from his ordeal with a permanent transformation in his personality, and the conviction that he has discovered a great truth or a new spiritual world. Many of the 19th and 20th century figures recognized unquestionably as great, Nietzsche, Darwin, Dostoevsky, Tolstoy, Freud, Jung, Piaget, were additionally characterized by lengthy periods of profound psychological unrest and uncertainty. Their psychopathology, a term ridiculous in this context, was generated as a consequence of the revolutionary nature of their personal experience, their action, fantasy, and thought. It is no great leap of comparative psychology to see their role in our society as analogous to that of the archaic religious leader and healer. For the average tribal individual, socially imposed initiation signifies the death of childhood and reintegration on the level of social maturity. For the future shaman, voluntarily undertaken initiation signifies the disintegration of socially determined adult personality and reintegration at the level of unique individuality. This process is illustrated in Figure 50, the dual death of the revolutionary hero. Those who undergo a second initiation suffer more deeply and profoundly from life than their peers. They are, in Jung's phrase, the most complex and differentiated minds of their age. These creative individuals detect emergent anomaly and begin the process of adaptation to it long before the average person notices any change whatsoever in circumstance. In his ecstasy, the shaman lives the potential future life of his society. This dangerous individual can play a healing role in his community because he has suffered more through experience than his peers. If someone in the community or the community itself becomes ill, breaks down, begins the journey, so to speak, to the land of the dead, the terrible unknown, the shaman is there to serve as guide, to provide rationale for current experience, to reunite the suffering individual with his community, or to renew the community. To restabilize the paradigmatic context of expectation and desire within which individual and social experience remains tolerable. The truly creative individual has been there and done that, and can therefore serve as a guide to others voluntarily beginning or roughly thrown into similar voyages. The archaic shamanic initiate was commonly someone uniquely marked by fate, by the will of the gods, by particular heredity, magical, novel occurrence in early childhood or later in life, birth in a call, survival of lightning strike, or by intrapsychic idiosyncrasy, epileptic susceptibility, visionary proclivity. His unique personality or experiential history, in combination with presently extant social conditions, doomed him to experience so anomalous that it could not simultaneously be accepted as actually occurring, as real, and as possible within the confines determined by ruling social presumption. The existence of this experience, if admitted and processed, therefore presented a potentially fatal challenge to the perceived validity of the axioms currently underlying the maintenance of normal sanity, the socio-historically determined stability of mutually determined behavioral adaptation and experiential significance. The existence of this distinct experience served as a gateway to the unknown, or as a floodgate, a portal, through which the unexpected could pour, with inevitably destructive and potentially creative consequences. The shaman is the individual who chooses to meet such a flood head-on. The shaman, the ecstatic in general, equally the revolutionary philosopher or scientist true to himself, is characterized by stubborn adherence to his own idiosyncratic field of experience in which occurrences emerge, procedural, episodic, or semantic in structure, that are foreign to the predictably socialized man and his prosaic moral expectation. The experiential range of the creative agent transcends the domain of the current adaptive sufficiency of his culture as it is extant socially and embodied and represented intrapsychically. Rather than ignoring or failing to process such occurrences, which exist in contradiction to or completely outside his conditional socially determined expectations and acting as though they do not exist, the creative individual voluntarily admits their reality and submits himself to the dissolution of his current moral worldview and pattern of action. This dissolution of personality, equivalent in episodic representation to death, temporarily re-novelizes experience. Furthermore, it provides the precondition for more inclusive resurrection of order, personal and social. The future shaman is in fact tormented by the incomplete or self-contradictory state of his cultural structure as it is intrapsychically represented, is undergoing a breakdown induced by some aspect of personal experience, some existential anomaly that cannot be easily integrated into that structure. This breakdown re-exposes him to the unknown, previously covered, so to speak, by his culture. His comportment during the period of incubation preceding his emergence as shaman is generally marked by commission of acts considered characteristic in modern and archaic culture alike of serious mental breakdown. He behaves idiosyncratically, seeking solitude, flying into fits of rage, losing consciousness, living in the mountains or woods alone, and suffering from visions and periods of absent-mindedness. His peers explain his odd behavior as possession. This experience of dissolution and re-exposure to chaos accompanies intrapsychic subjugation to the operation of innate, involuntary, episodic, limbic, right hemisphere governed mechanisms responsible for the deconstruction and renewal of conditional knowledge. This operation manifests itself subjectively in structured mythic experience, in spontaneous personal experience, which adheres to the pattern associated with ritualized social initiation, and which may also have served originally as its source. The soul of the shaman is carried away by spirits, habituants of the episodic realm, and returned to the place of the gods. This place exists outside of time and space itself, on the same plane of pleromatic reality as the prehistoric and post-apocalyptic paradise. Entry into this domain is preceded by complete psychic disintegration, accompanied by horrifying visions of torture, dismemberment, and death. The shamanic initiate descends into the matriarchal hell that preceded and coexists with creation, passing through clashing rocks or gates in the shape of jaws. He is reduced to a skeleton while his disembodied head observes the procedure. He has his internal organs removed or restructured. His bones are broken, his eyes gouged out. He is devoured by a serpent or a giantess, is boiled, roasted, or otherwise reduced to his essential and fundamental structure, to his very bones. Iliada states, "The total crisis of the future shaman, sometimes leading to complete disintegration of the personality and to madness, can be evaluated not only as an initiatory death, but also as a symbolic return to the pre-cosmogonic chaos, to the amorphous and indescribable state that precedes any cosmogony. Now, as we know, for archaic and traditional cultures, a symbolic return to chaos is equivalent to preparing a new creation. It follows that we may interpret the psychic chaos of the future shaman as a sign that the profane man is being dissolved and a new personality being prepared for birth. This disintegration is the removal of experience, objects, and processes from their socially determined state of provisional paradigm-governed significance and their return to the affectively numinous unknown, infinitely threatening and promising. Exposure to consequently renovelized experience constitutes the affective and motivational core of the ecstatic experience, the basis for the religious experience, and the experience of meaning as such, prior to its entrapment and canalization in dogma. Dissolution is experienced in imaginal or episodic representation as death, an accurate conceptualization, death of socialized personality. Dissolution of the presently constituted intrapsychic representation and procedural embodiment of action patterns historically constructed and currently deemed morally acceptable. The justifiable terror consideration of the consequences of such decomposition induces constitutes a major impediment to the pursuit of redemptive change, a formidable barrier to intrapsychic integration. The shamanic process of transformation appears as the means by which cognitive systems are updated when necessary. The affect that is released during the process is necessarily part of the experience. Every major step forward, therefore, has some of the aspect of the revolutionary descent into madness. Change shades gradually from the normal to the radical. The structure of this process formulates itself easily into imagistic representation, even among children far too young to develop any explicitly statable knowledge about such occurrences. The following dream was described by my daughter, Michaela, then 3 years, 9 months old, about my son, Julian, 1 year, 11 months old, on October 5th, 1995. Julian was in a time of toilet training and rapid speech development, and was having some trouble controlling his emotions. Michaela liked to call him Baby. We had several discussions about the fact that he really wasn't a baby anymore. She told me this story while I was at the computer, so I was able to get it verbatim. Michaela, Julian's eyes falled out, and then he falled into pieces. Dad, what sort of pieces? Michaela, Julian pieces, and the bones falled out too. Then a hole got him, and there was water in it, and when he came out, he was big. Mum, Julian isn't a baby anymore? Michaela,